Hello there, and welcome to the latest edition of the DF Direct Q&A show. You've got questions, we've got answers. Hopefully, joining me, first of all, hello, Will Judd.
Hello, it's good to be here, as infrequently as ever.
However, there are questions specifically aimed at you, so this is a good one. Okay, and also joining us, John Linneman, hello.
Hello, happy to be here on this Judd-tacular Monday. It's great to be joined by Will Judd. It's been awesome having you back, Will. I just want to say that so the public can hear it. Good having the proper support on the back end, the website stuff. So, yeah, good job, man. Welcome back.
Absolutely. Okay, well, I guess we should just crack on with the questions. Okay, then. So let's kick off with our first questions of the week. And we're actually having to refilm this because the dynamic situation with Microsoft is so dynamic that it seems to be changing on a 24-hourly basis. So our previous responses to these questions needs to be completely recalibrated. Let's kick off with this one from Skyrim 26 FPS edition. When I see Satya Nadella quoted as saying, "Now we have to turn Xbox into a sustainable business," why do I mentally insert "or else" afterwards? Supposed options are spinning it off, presumably to die and be reborn as Activision Blizzard 2 Private Equity Edition, or turning it into a JV, i.e. dead but someone, maybe Asus gets the brand. I think that's probably pushing things a bit, although things are pretty dire, seemingly. I just hope for a quick resolution of the Xbox fiasco, as I want this industry to succeed, and maybe taking a player off the board will help that. Dajarko, in brackets, Dan. Lads, exclamation point, what do you think to the recent rumblings that Microsoft is even considering spinning off or selling Xbox? Who would your preferred buyer be? Could Elon Musk really do a worse job? Absolutely, yes, without doubt. If he bought it under his macro hard anti-Microsoft company name, would we be living in some kind of mirror universe, more like a sort of dystopian reality where everything has kind of gone horribly wrong? Although some might say the last 10 years is pretty much evidence of a Kelvin-style divergence in the timeline. John, yes, we originally responded to these questions in the first draft, at the first recording session, but we were kind of like, wanting Microsoft to just shut up and get on with business, basically. I think that was the overriding messages, because Satya Nadella was basically coming out and saying, hey, you know, we've been subsidizing video games for the last 25 years. It's time for video games to pay us back, essentially. And in the time since we recorded the first response to this topic, well, basically, parts of the plan are starting to become apparent, and it's pretty, pretty bad news, right?
Yes. I was commenting earlier that the whiplash from this whole situation is honestly staggering, because I think we came out of that recent sort of pseudo E3 presentation feeling pretty good about things, right? Like, yeah, it seemed like they were heading in a good direction. It seemed like, you know, there would be some sacrifices, unfortunately, but what seems to be sort of coming out now suggests that it's actually a lot worse than we're expecting, with studios either being spun out as independent in the best cases or simply being shuttered. And the names that are being mentioned is what's so concerning. Like, in the case of Compulsion Games, for instance, I don't like to see that. I think they made a really cool game. They've done some good stuff, but, you know, they haven't made enough games, one could argue, and the sales and performance of it was really poor. I mean, I can understand where the decision would come from, but when you're hearing, you know, you see Arcane is mentioned, Ninja Theory is being mentioned despite just announcing a brand new game. Sounds like Double Fine's going to spin out on their own, hopefully. And then even stuff like Machine Games and id Software comes up as potential things that could either get shut down or hit. We don't yet know what's going to happen, but like, it's just going too far. It's like they're saying, hey, we're just going to close all the developers you guys like.
Right.
And that comment about them just wanting to chase, it sounds like they just want to chase like the ultra high end AAA sort of experiences, whittle down their portfolio to just the basics that like hit that market, and that's it. And
right.
I guess basically the best thing we can hope for is that these developers are able to essentially exit from Microsoft gracefully and somehow continue, right? If they could continue, right, that would be okay. But I don't want to see studios shut down and mass layoffs occur over this. And if that's the case, if they're just essentially removing so much talent and experience, it just feels like they're creating the problem that got them in this position in the first place, right? Like, if you really go back historically and look, the Xbox 360 had a remarkably strong first and third party lineup. So did the original Xbox even, but 360 especially. But then there was a point where, and I think this was on Don Matrick's watch, where they basically like whittled down their first party stuff to almost nothing. And they either focused too much on Kinect or they just didn't have much. Right. Because they were so, you know, convinced that the third-party support was all they needed. And then they spent years and years and years building up their first-party portfolio again. And now I would say over the last 5 years, Xbox has had a pretty great stream of games being released, right? Like, their developers are producing. There's a lot of stuff in the works. Like, it seemed like things on the software side were going well. And now it sounds like they just want to close it all down again. And they're just going to wind up in that same stupid situation. And it's just emblematic of this constant feeling that they have no vision for where to go forward. And it's just decisions are being made on the whim, and every year it could be different. There was that clip from Psycho Odyssey about the making of Psychonauts 2 that always goes around, where somebody was asking about, like, you know, when corporate visits, and like, oh yeah, we love like Matt Booty and Phil Spencer and them, you know, they're the fun guys. It's what happens when Bill from accounting and so from marketing comes in on Friday. That's the problem. And it just feels like they put on a face that's like says one thing, and then, you know, the penny pinchers come in. It's almost like they just leave them to, they say, oh, we're going to be hands off of the studios, but they provide no guidance or support. And then all of a sudden they look at the, you know, finances and say, oh, we got to do something about this. Sorry, guys. And it just kind of keeps happening. So,
right. Yeah. I mean, I'm just looking at reporting from Tom Warren, who is very well integrated, lots of sources within Microsoft. He's saying that Xbox is closing down Ninja Theory, Compulsion Games, and Double Fine are also in quote unquote active negotiations about spinning off. I wish them well. He also refers to an interview that Asha Sharma and Matt Booty gave with Windows Central. And I'm just going to quote this. The first conversations Asha and I had when we first met to do all of this, to her credit, she immediately emphasized supporting our studios and our games. Our ecosystem is built to be a portfolio of everything from small games to ongoing franchises to the big blockbusters. We've built at our core to build everything from Kiln to Call of Duty, everything from Minecraft to South of Midnight. That's core to how we're set up. This is Matt Booty here. I think we've got one of the best portfolios out there, even in the entertainment industry more broadly in terms of that range. We're dedicated to it, and here's why. I believe that almost everything big started out as something small. We cannot lose the ability to have those places where little sparks can grow into something big. The creative environment that lets us take bets and creative risks has to be part of Xbox's culture. We're committed. Our studio system is built for that. Well, are they committed based on the fact that, you know, it doesn't look as though a lot of these studios are going to be supported in the way that was suggested there? It's kind of shocking, really, the you know, there's always a legacy quote that comes up to bite Microsoft in the behind whenever there's a big move like this. It really does suggest that there's just no sort of coherent strategy. I'm staggered. I shouldn't be, based on everything that's happened, but I am.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's just that whiplash between, you know, the executive statements, which seem very reasonable and seem like there's a clear direction in place. The Xbox showcase, which was really positive, really exciting, as, you know, an Xbox fan or somebody who just enjoys the games on PC. Seems like there's plenty going on. And, you know, as they say, like a good range from AAA stuff down to AA stuff and indie games all kind of included. But, you know, and then the other shoe drops, and then this is the kind of stuff that we have to deal with, right? And that these developers have to deal with, more importantly, is that it seems like, you know, there's going to be a very harsh reset for a lot of studios. And I'm sure that beyond the closures and the studios being spun off, there's also going to be a lot of them that are facing layoffs, right? So it's, yeah, it's just really problematic. I think especially, you know, for Ninja Theory to have had a game announced and have such a positive reception to it, and then to be in the headlines a few days later to say, oh yeah, and probably the studio won't exist after that. Like, will that game even come out? Will it come out and then the studio closes down? Like, neither of those are great options. And yeah, it's just a real shame. Like, obviously, there's a lot of pressure from Xbox and certain parts of it, at least, to be always producing bangers, you know, being capable of producing these kind of evergreen titles that people will just spend almost unlimited amounts of money on. But I think it's really important for Microsoft and for Xbox to also be supporting these kind of mid-level studios that have more reasonable budgets, that aren't taking huge swings on everything, and are able to come out with games that are made at a reasonable price. And, you know, therefore you get a lot of different bites of the cherry, right? So yeah, just super disappointing news. And yeah, hard to see how this kind of jibes with everything that Microsoft's executives have said before.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the ecosystem seemed to be designed for Game Pass to create a range of games of varying sizes and varying shapes and different types of games to support a vibrant subscription-based offering. And I think, you know, it took years to get there. And I think, you know, part of the issue that Microsoft had with Xbox Series in particular is that there was a failure to deliver games in those first few years. That has kind of like been reversed at this point. We've had some sensational games from Microsoft. We had this fantastic showcase just a few weeks ago. There seems to be, I don't know, John, there seems to be this incredible sort of lack of self-awareness about everything that they're messaging to the audience at this point. You know, because obviously they went into this showcase and were going to show great things. There was a lot of interaction between management and the fan base. And then this happens like weeks later. I just don't understand the reasoning or the strategy here. It just doesn't make sense. And, you know, if there are poor decisions being made just on the messaging side, then what else is going on? I mean, man, this is just crazy stuff.
From the outside, there's this sense that there's a huge conflict that's brewed between, say, the Xbox group and Microsoft corporate. You know, people like Satya Nadella at the top, what they want doesn't really seem to align well with this. And when you see them all interviewed separately, they often make statements that feel kind of conflicting, which makes it seem like they all have their own desires for things and kind of let that slip. And there's no like real unified message here, which makes me do. It makes me feel like Xbox, I don't know how this is possible, but it would be interesting to see it spun out as its own thing somehow. At least somewhat separate from Microsoft corporate. I mean, we know that Satya is all in on Copilot and AI and all that nonsense. Like, to him, like, I think he is exactly the type of person that would feel zero remorse about laying off the entire gaming team, every single person, so he could, you know, invest more in AI. I genuinely think he would not care. It's that type of like personality we're probably dealing with here. And I think this is not what's interesting to him as a business leader, and it doesn't feel like it suits what Microsoft is right now. You know what I mean? Like, Microsoft of 2026 is not the same Microsoft that started Xbox. And I think I would like to see all this Xbox stuff, because we know a lot of people that work at Xbox, right? We have like friends and contacts within all these studios and Xbox proper. I do believe that the people working within that organization genuinely do actually care about this stuff, and they want to make great things, but they're limited by this management situation and being part of Microsoft as a company. So if they could find a way to split, that would be wonderful, but how that's possible, I do not know.
Right. I think, you know, fundamentally the issue with spinning off from Microsoft is that they would still be the effective owner. They would just be outside of the corporate structure to a certain degree.
And maybe that would be what's necessary to make the decisions that are actually good for the gaming business. I don't know. Like, this is, there's just, there's, too much going on here, and we don't have enough information. I think most of what we're saying is just born out of frustration of seeing a business that we love and care about essentially being like ground down into nothing. And this like constant whiplash between like a positive message and then a negative message. And unfortunately, I feel like the Western gaming industry especially is just in a really bad place right now. Microsoft's not the only one doing this, but it's pretty severe from their camp. And I feel like what we're really seeing is the effects that we all cautioned about. It's like all these acquisitions and like creating large conglomerates built from so many different companies. It's not sustainable and it's going to end badly. And I think there's definitely cases where certain acquisitions may have occurred because the company could no longer operate independently and they essentially needed an out. And this essentially just bought them time. But I don't believe that's the case in every situation. So I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there does seem to be like inconsistency in messaging because, and this goes back to the whole four games situation, the business update, where, you know, we heard about the beginnings of a multi-platform plan, which everybody kind of knew was already fully formed or very close to it. And at the same time as that was happening, you know, there was very sort of careful messaging from management at that point, even though it didn't feel particularly accurate. But at the same time, you had Satya Nadella basically wading in with his size 12s, saying, yeah, you know, what's the point of exclusives, that sort of thing, basically undermining management. So, you know, there does seem to be a continuing sort of friction between Microsoft and Xbox leadership. And now it seems to be the same thing happening again, where, you know, we've basically got comments that were being made by new management just a few weeks or you know, a couple of months ago, basically disappearing and complete about face on strategy is just absolutely baffling. I think there's just got to be a firm sort of strategy that they're going to commit to that is positively communicated to the community, because what on earth is all of this about? And it is just, you know, this lack of self-awareness. You know, Satya was talking about obviously the big hardware issues that we've got at the moment. And, you know, complete sort of lack of self-awareness that Microsoft is a key player in actually causing all of that. And no sort of evidence that Microsoft is, you know, going to help out Xbox in navigating through this, when surely they can to a certain degree. Nope, it looks as though that they've made their investment over the last 25 years. YouTube is making more money off Xbox than Xbox is, which is baffling. I don't know where that comment came from. I just don't know what to make of all of this at this point. And it's funny because we did record an initial response to these questions yesterday, in fact, where it was kind of like, okay, maybe they just need to shut up and get on with it and then, you know, come up with a strategy and execute it. And, you know, it's sort of, we have to redo our own content now to adjust to Microsoft's changing messaging over 24 hours. Absolutely baffling, absolutely bizarre. But no, I still think that Elon Musk would probably do a worse job.
Oh, yeah, undoubtedly.
Any final comments, Will?
I would just say that, you know, if this is going to come to pass, I really hope that they say, okay, we've had to close some studios, we had to make some layoffs, but from now on, we're going to invest in the studios that remain. We're going to be try and get ourselves into a really strong position so that when Helix comes out, it'll be supported by a really good, like, you know, launch library, right? I think that has to be the goal here. And if these cuts are necessary to make that happen, then, you know, it still is incredibly painful, but at least it would have been worth it in some sense, right? So I just hoped that this is the start of a consistent strategy that actually sets them up for some kind of success in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I echo that. I think the bottom line is that we just need to know what the plan is. And I think more to the point, the staff at Microsoft in all the development studios and, you know, and within Xbox itself kind of need to know what's going on, because I don't think anybody does at this point. It's just absolutely, absolutely baffling. A final comment from you, John.
What you said, Will, that sounds so hopeful. That would be nice. But I'm sure that's exactly what they thought when they launched Xbox Series X and S, right? And yep. It didn't pay out. So Although they did actually end up getting the games, but I feel like now it's just, I don't know. All I'll say is if they dare touch a company like id Software or something, I will never forgive them. I was super angry over the things with like Blue Point and all that with Sony. But if you go after a studio like id that has produced nothing but greatness and the best technology in the industry and try to shut them down or cut them to pieces, like, no, it's not okay. I could never forgive that.
I think basically, you know, an explainer to the audience about what has happened and why, rather than just, you know, typically what happens is a memo from the CEO is sent to the staff and that memo is then shared with the audience. And the memo is basically word salad. It's no real sort of proper explanation. It's challenging conditions, that sort of wordage. What's going on? You know, Xbox, you can't reach out to your fan base, try to reconnect with them, show them amazing games, and then basically come back a couple of weeks later and say, well, actually, we've got some real problems here. Sorry. It's just absolutely bizarre. Anyway, I think we can all hopefully move on. Okay, sort of leading on from that, interesting question here from Dudley the Gentleman. Hello, renowned pixel purity police. Do you see the Xbox brand becoming the next 3DO where Microsoft defines the specifications and OEMs build the hardware? If so, how can they be successful where 3DO and even Valve with the original Steam machines have failed? I think that is probably a key part of the strategy, right, John, where they're talking about partnerships, hardware partnerships. Will, we had a discussion the other day. It's like, well, why are Microsoft seemingly so badly affected by these component shortages when Microsoft is buying a lot of the components elsewhere within the business? And I'll come to you shortly on that, John, but 3DO, obviously, you know, there's associations that this wasn't really a great thing. It didn't really make an impact. It's an interesting idea. Is it the new 3DO? Could Project Helix be the new 3DO? Is there a positive spin on that?
I mean, maybe, but I think conceptually what they did with 3DO was interesting, but it's just like the time and place, the market conditions now are just so fundamentally different that I don't really think it's even remotely comparable. 3DO, ultimately, the biggest issue there was obviously software was not as good as it needed to be, though it's not bad. But right. Secondly, that model at the time, game consoles really relied on being subsidized, right? So it was the Blades and Razor model, essentially, or Blade and Razor's model, where essentially, you know, they sell the hardware often at a loss. They make it up with software licensing. But due to the way 3DO worked, you know, if you have Panasonic or Gold Star, whoever making a 3DO back then, they didn't get anything from the software, really, right? So there was no benefit to them selling units at a loss, so they didn't. And that's kind of why the price had to be as high as it was. And I think at the time, it was just way too expensive, didn't have enough software. And it was just a crazy time in the market in general. Everything was in flux. And so, you know, a year or some change later, Sony comes along and does a similar thing, but way better. There was no chance. Now we're in the era of, hardware in general is more expensive. Xbox as a brand is already established, right? 3DO had to be built up from nothing. And Xbox already has a very large library of games and publishers working for it. And it owns tons of development studios. I mean, they have what they need for software support. So if they were to take this approach, conceivably, like, the software side wouldn't really be an issue, which is why it could still find success. But I don't know what that would mean for prices. And I mean, if OEMs are building this hardware, but I don't think companies today take as much of a loss on hardware as they used to. It feels like, we need to actually check the numbers on that, but I don't know. And I still think that Xbox itself, at least I would imagine that it's still going to manufacture at least its own first party devices to some degree. Like, I don't think it's all going to become like Asus ROG boxes and stuff like that. like, I still have a feeling that Helix or whatever it is going to end up having an actual official Microsoft built device.
Oh, sure. Yeah. They've committed to it. They're making it.
Right.
The reference device. It's happening.
Exactly. So that's a different thing. You know, if they allow others to make a similar thing, that's, you know, that is more like what the 3DO did, but 3DO never had its own reference device.
Yeah.
So
what we need is a Project Helix Wonder Mega.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's the Sega really did used to do that, right? Like they had their main systems, but then they let companies like JVC make their own stuff. And damn, if anybody has a Wonder Mega, man, that's the one, that's my white whale for retro consoles, the original Wonder Mega. I've been wanting one of those for so long, but man, they're tough to get.
Will, let's talk about this OEM strategy. I'm a bit confused by it because, surely it's just adding somebody else to the supply chain that wants to make money out of these devices. So, you know, obviously there's going to be AMD making all of the chips, right? TSMC probably making, actually fabricating the chips. AMD, I don't know, are they kind of making a license? I guess it is a license deal with Microsoft. So Microsoft would then sell the chips to Asus, MSI, whoever wants them, Dell. And, you know, surely this is just like somebody else in the chain who needs to make money out of this device. And how are they going to make money on it? I'm a bit confused by that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a weird situation. Like with the ROG Ally, it kind of made sense because Asus had already produced this device and Microsoft could make some small hardware changes, make some bigger software changes, and then they had a product that made sense. But for Helix, I don't know if that's kind of the same situation. Obviously, Asus and Dell and whoever isn't going to have, you know, 90% of a viable Project Helix sitting around. So I think if they do go down this route, it might be more about adapting it to different regions. Like, for example, like Valve, they kind of let other companies in China run, you know, the Steam network and run, you know, and sell devices and things like that, right? Where they're kind of handing over some responsibilities to local experts. So I could see a situation like that where they say, okay, we're going to make Project Helix for China and it's going to be made by a Chinese company and it's going to have different software and it's going to have all these, you know, adaptations that make it more viable there. And, you know, you could do the same thing with South Korea or Japan or another kind of big but slightly different market. In terms of just, you know, having it wholesale, I think, yeah, it does just kind of complicate things and there would need to be a good reason to do it. I guess diversifying, you know, the investments and things like that would be good. But yeah, it's hard to say that there's like a huge need for, you know, Project Helix to be made for like by 12 different companies unless they're doing something genuinely interesting with the hardware or the software or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the only thing I can think of is that possibly they would have superior procurement on stuff like SSDs and memory modules compared to Microsoft, but that is kind of staggering in its own. Yeah, just the conceit of that is kind of hard to believe. You know, Microsoft have been making, even without all of the server stuff, they've been making laptops, they've been making consoles. They've had relationships, presumably, with TSMC and the memory manufacturers for decades. So I'm still sort of a bit mystified by all of this. What I can see is that if Helix is indeed a machine that is just as much a PC as it is a console, then there could be bespoke designs designed for specific PC use cases, because obviously the great thing about the PC is the diversity of the components that could go into one or the use cases, you know. So you could possibly have a Helix machine that has more memory, for example, if you wanted to also use it for production tasks or something like that. So then you sort of build up an ecosystem of Xbox adjacent or even Xbox branded devices, but they are made by like MSI, Dell or whatever. And I do think, you know, from a value perspective compared to some of the pre-builts, there is probably going to be a good value argument there. But, you know, a mainstream device, I find it really hard to imagine those guys coming up with that particular device for that particular audience, because there's not really any money in it. Okay, let's move on. Okay, so a question here from Marcus. Hiya, Foundryman! Exclamation point. What are your thoughts on ARM's new quote-unquote neural technology stack for mobile graphics with neural supersampling, neural frame rate upscaling, and neural supersampling and denoising? Seems like an unusually open attempt at an ML rendering suite for mobile covering upscaling, frame interpolation, and combined upscaling and denoising. Could this be important for vendors that do not have something like DLSS, Metal Effects, FSR, or a mature in-house solution? More broadly, could open developer-facing tools like this help raise image quality across Android phones, handheld class devices, and perhaps eventually Windows on ARM systems? I hope you have a great week! Exclamation point. Thanks for that, Marcus. Well, we were going to talk about this in the Direct last week, but we didn't because, well, you actually did the article on digitalfoundry.net. You spoke to the people involved, and I thought we'd save it up for you to talk about.
Yeah, so it's a pretty cool announcement, really. So it's essentially a whole version of the kind of DLSS suite of technologies. So there's upsampling, there's upsampling with denoising, there's frame generation under a different name. And yeah, it's very, very cool. It's got you know, some limitations, but they've already demonstrated it by building an entire game with Sumo Digital, which is about 2 hours, which feels like a full-length game for a mobile system. And it seems to allow, you know, enough extra performance headroom that you can do some really cool, more advanced graphical techniques on what is fundamentally a very low-power device. So they've demonstrated it with Unreal Engine 5 megalights. And they've got kind of an interesting cave system that has all these bioluminescent things in the background, all drawing, you know, doing their own lighting. And yeah, it's an interesting idea. I think the key limitation at the moment is that this is going to require future ARM hardware, I guess their next generation Mali GPU, to work. So that means that until that hardware is actually in the hands of a significant number of people, you can't fully rely on it to produce a game, right? But what it does do is it makes the development process a lot quicker and easier as well, because you don't have to bake out lighting and then see how it looks and then adjust things. You can, you know, have artists working and seeing their changes in real time. And then after you get to the end of that process, presumably you can then say, okay, and now we convert this to a baked alternative. So it's still interesting, and the fact that they're releasing a toolkit and they're releasing all the assets from the game is a really cool move. And it seems like, you know, they just want to make sure that this level of technology is available to a whole new, you know, platform, a whole new audience. And yeah, it's fascinating. I think we'll probably have to wait until we see the game running, you know, on real hardware to get a better sense of how it does in terms of image quality. Certainly what they've released looks like the image quality isn't, you know, certainly the highest end that you would expect from a PC or a console. And there are some question marks over performance as well, especially in terms of touch latency and how that interacts with 30 FPS to a 60 FPS frame rate upscale, aka frame gen. So very, very interesting so far. I think, you know, as an open source, open kind of project, it's really worth you know, mentioning and highlighting, and gives a lot of interesting ideas for mobile developers, no doubt. But yeah, really cool.
Yeah, they put out a video asset, and I'm sort of curious about why they did that, because they're talking about, you know, upscaling, frame generation, and then they put out a 30 FPS video. So, you know, show us the frame generation, please, because we're not seeing it in a 30 FPS video. It's just kind of bizarre. But yeah, it's an interesting step forward. But, you know, there've been kind of lots of technology demos we've seen in the past for mobile that, you know, never really translate into final products. And there isn't really any kind of need for them because, you know, cutting edge rendering on a mobile phone isn't really done anymore. So I'm very curious as to why they did this. But, you know, the sentiment behind it, the, you know, to actually go open with all of these technologies, I think is to be commended. Do you have any thoughts there, John?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think the open nature of this is actually potentially important if it can take off. I mean, just being open doesn't necessarily mean success, but I mean, they're targeting mid to lower end devices and mobile in general, where there's more sensitivity towards battery life. And Android, traditionally, they haven't really had a solution for this. Other solutions, like on Apple, for instance, the metal effects stuff, it's all closed, proprietary, right? Yeah. DLSS itself, proprietary. FSR is, and XeSS are kind of open, but they're still more fixed function-y, and there's still limitations there. So this is kind of like, you know, this feels like a pretty awesome solution, especially when targeting those mobile devices. It could be good for basically allowing lower res rendering on mobile, where battery is so important, but mm-hmm. a lot of the other stuff, I'm not sure how important that'll actually wind up being in practice. Talking to people that are into like big mobile games, for instance, the high-end Unreal stuff for typically isn't very popular, or there's issues with it because it is notorious for just being heavier on the phone, draining the battery faster, taking longer to load up. One of the things that helped make like miHoYo's stuff so popular, like Genshin, is that it looks beautiful, but it's actually like pretty lightweight, right? It's a Unity-based game, but it's fairly lightweight. It's quick to load. It actually runs quite well. But maybe this could help make some of the more advanced stuff a little bit more reasonable. We'll see. I don't know. It's yeah. good, though. It's always good to see additional open standards dropped into the market. It just reminds me of what was the standard prior to Vulkan?
OpenGL?
No. There was that one that I'm forgetting the name that was developed before Vulkan.
What, Mantle? What was it?
Mantle. Yes. Remember Mantle?
I do.
I don't know. That just sprung to mind.
Okay. Yeah. Mantle. What a time.
Awesome. Yes.
Okay. Let's move on. I got a question here from Andreas Wright. Hey, DFO overlords. I'm not sure who we're overlording over, but whatever. Hey, DF overlords. Due to leaks on Nvidia reportedly releasing 50 series supercards, do you think these are necessary? And what specs prices should we be expecting? So, yeah, I mean, we were kind of expecting this year, but owing to the memory crisis, it never happened. But the 50 series line was to receive a refresh, which would have seen essentially cards that have got 2 gigabyte memory modules replaced with 3 gigabyte memory modules. So an RTX 5070 would go up from 12 gigabytes to 18 gigabytes, which sounds pretty awesome, right? And 16 to 24 for like the 5070 Ti and 5080, and, you know, it's not too bad. Potentially the idea of a 12 gigabyte RTX 5060, I would be super on board with that. Will, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a normal year, this definitely would have happened and it would have made sense. And I mean, I think one of the major criticisms of NVIDIA graphics cards over, you know, the past 5 years has been that they haven't really kept pace in terms of VRAM allocations, certainly yep. compared to AMD, which seems to see 16 gigabytes as more of a standard for a mid-range and above card. So, you know, using more advanced memory chips that have 3 gigabytes instead of 2, that makes total sense. It allows them to not have to change much else in terms of the design and still bump up the VRAM to levels which, you know, I feel 12 gigabytes is extremely reasonable for a 60 series class product. So
absolutely,
I think it makes a ton of sense. In terms of pricing, it's hard to say. Normally the super lineup kind of replaces the original cards at the same price, because those original cards will have, you know, gone down in price in the intervening, you know, months or years. But given the current memory crisis and how much everything costs, that extends to VRAM, so it's hard to see if that is necessarily what we should expect. I ran some numbers and I'm kind of thinking 5060 Super would be 349 to 399 possibly. 5070 Super, 559, 5070 Ti Super, 749, and 5080 Super, 999. Again, if they're kind of replacing those original cards at a similar price. So I think, you know, competitively, these look really good. But again, we're in such an unprecedented time at the moment that it's really hard to predict with any level of certainty what these things are going to cost. But, you know, the core concept is at least solid, and I would welcome this.
Yeah, I think NVIDIA are in a hard place, right? Because if the next generation GPUs have also been delayed, which seems likely, right? It's not beyond the realms of possibility. Then can you go 2 years without a new GeForce product launch? That would be asking quite a lot, right? The question is availability of these higher density memory modules and how much it costs them to buy, which we just don't know. So pricing could be anything, really. We just have no idea whatsoever. The weird thing is, from my perspective, is that we are in the middle of a memory crisis. We have seen comments from Asha Sharma from Xbox about, you know, ballooning prices. And yet you can still buy an RX 9070 XT and a 9070 for reasonable prices. The other week, you could buy an RTX 5070 in the UK for less than its original launch price. I'm wondering what's going on there. Is there something in terms of the sort of supply chain that we're missing here? Because those prices, you know, they're not bad. Certainly nowhere near as bad as what's been happening on the SSD front and on the DDR5 side of things. So I'm kind of curious as to how that's all sort of panning out. But John, new graphics cards, even if they are essentially the same generation with more memory, that would be pretty good, right?
I mean, sure, but we already have a product coming out again. It's called the RTX 3060.
Yes, somehow it has returned.
I mean, sure, style. It's more cards would be nice, I guess. It's just we're still in this weird spot with pricing and availability, so it's really hard to say. And launching anything new, it's just going to sell out quickly. They probably won't make that many. I don't know. We're still in a weird. I said the other day, like, it feels like they made it to the 5090, and then they like put the, you know, they marked their spot on the rock, and they're like, all right, we've gone far enough. Let's go back down the mountain. And like, it's like, are we going to see anything beyond that level anytime soon?
Not anytime soon. No, the 6090, I guess, possibly yes. But that's going to be someday. Some time away. Yeah, someday.
I don't know. It's just it feels like the whole GPU situation is really strange right now. And there isn't that much demand, I think, for new, faster cards at the moment. Like, they're already very fast for all software available. The prices are really, really high. I think at this point, most gamers would be like, well, if I have cash for a better graphics card, that probably already exists, and I'll just put my money on that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do think the sentiment might be changing, John, because it's interesting you make that point. When the 5070 came out, you know, it was basically it was badly reviewed because it wasn't that much better than a 4070 Super. Obviously, NVIDIA made these crazy comparisons with the 4090, and that didn't go particularly well. However, the 5070, you know, it's a good card, I think. You could do path tracing on it. You could do multi-frame generation. I could play Pragmata with path tracing at 1440p, you know, at like 160 frames per second. It's all right, you know? And I guess the fact is that when the 5070 came out, you couldn't buy a 4070 Super anymore. So the comparison there was kind of a bit strange. I think there's obviously a pushback against the fact that raw performance hadn't improved. I think that's a valid point, right? But ultimately, if the scope of the requirements of games isn't actually changing either, then effectively it's a replacement product that's got some nice extra features, which, you know, it's okay, I think. If I was unable to play, like, great games on the 5070 or, you know, I wasn't able to do path tracing on it, that'd be a different thing. But it's kind of been okay. Let's move on to another question here. And, what can we say about this one? Spodlude asks, please can you summarize Intel and NVIDIA's suspected collaboration and what this means for the future of Arc? We're going back a while here, aren't we, Will? But it's not a suspected collaboration. There is a collaboration between NVIDIA and Intel, and I believe NVIDIA owns a good chunk of Intel stock as a result of that collaboration. But it is potentially quite exciting what they're doing there, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the core idea is that there will be an Intel SoC for like a laptop or a gaming handheld or whatever. And instead of an ARC graphics portion, it'll have an RTX graphics portion, which could be, you know, potentially more powerful, could have a higher top end. And probably the most important thing is it gets access to DLSS then, which is, from what we've seen on the Switch 2 and from obviously just general PC gaming, is the best upscaler package generally. So yeah, it's pretty exciting. It's interesting to think about potential products that could use this. Certainly, you know, Intel just launched their own gaming handhelds powered by Arc graphics, and we'll have to see how they do in terms of power and performance and everything else. But this kind of gives them another option for a co-branded device that is able to potentially hit higher performance levels and do so with better upscaling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think about the future of Arc? Because there've been lots of rumors, as usual. I mean, it seems to be like pretty much every few months there's a new rumor that Arc is, in terms of its discrete graphics cards, is a thing of the past. But then you see Panther Lake, where you see a very, very good integrated solution. What do you think is the future of Arc?
Oh, gosh, it's hard to say, right? I mean, I get the idea that maybe Intel is a bit like Microsoft and there might be different factions within the company that see different paths right. for it. Because, you know, certainly we have a lot of people that are genuinely seem to be really big fans of Arc internally and want it to do well and, you know, have plans for all these, you know, discrete graphics cards and mobile chips and everything else. And the work that Intel engineers have done to, you know, make it a viable solution, both discrete and in terms of, you know, laptop integrated, has been, you know, really promising. So from that point of view, you would say that the NVIDIA stuff is maybe, you know, just a contractual obligation, or it's something that, you know, is not going to be the main thing going forwards. But I think it does give perhaps other factions within Intel that don't think that Arc is worth the investment a good kind of get out clause to say, ah, but we don't need to do our own things. We can just ask NVIDIA, who are already really good at this, to just handle these things going forward. So yeah, it's obviously all kind of based on rumors. We don't really know what these first products that are, you know, combining these two Intel and NVIDIA SoCs to, you know, we don't know what they're going to look like, and we'll have to wait until they're actually out and we can test them in terms of performance and features and everything else. But yeah, it's a complicated situation for sure.
Yeah, I think, you know, ultimately it is just going to be integrated processors with a Intel CPU and NVIDIA GPU, which sounds like, you know, the scale of it could be relatively limited. It could be something bigger. I mean, in the past, Intel actually did a similar collaboration with AMD, which was very, very, very short-lived. You had like an Intel CPU and like a Vega GPU, not the Radeon 7, I'm afraid, there, John. Fury X.
My favorite.
But, you know, potentially this could be really, really cool. You know, bringing those technologies together, I think it could be quite compelling. From a gaming perspective, maybe more compelling than the Windows on ARM stuff that NVIDIA is pursuing at the moment, because it bypasses the whole ARM situation. And Intel CPU cores are actually pretty good, right? So, you know, potentially good stuff there. What it means for the future of Arc, I honestly think that's a separate discussion, because, you know, releasing a product with an NVIDIA GPU doesn't mean that, you know, you suddenly have access to NVIDIA IP. And if Intel want to be competitive on the graphics front, on the AI front, they need good GPUs. I don't think Arc is going away. The consumer-facing side of it from gaming might change. Not really sure at the moment. What do you make of this suspected collaboration, John?
I mean, it seems not that different from what we've seen already with, like, you know, laptops with Intel CPUs and NVIDIA GPUs. I guess it's just would be an integration.
Yeah.
This just feels like a way to offer a high-end option while still leveraging Intel CPU cores, because, as we know, Arc doesn't really play in the high-end GPU market at all. So I think Arc would remain for now as a part of their mid to lower end stack, and they could deploy NVIDIA technology working together with them in higher end systems, basically, right? So that's basically the idea, I guess. And that sounds good to me.
I'm going to round off with a final quick question. This one comes from K-Back. What do you think of the rumors of Sega supposedly working on a low-powered handheld akin to the Evercade handhelds? Have you heard any rumblings on the digital web? Or is this pure hogwash? John, is it pure hogwash? Is there something afoot, do you think?
I don't know. I haven't heard anything about this rumor. It's interesting, though. Because Evercade is quietly, Blaze Entertainment, they have quietly carved themselves a weirdly successful little niche. Evercade devices are really cool. Like, yep, they're low-cost handheld units that play cartridge-based games. And they've now got, like, hundreds of games on that thing, including games that otherwise don't really have easily accessible physical versions at all. And just due to that low cost, it's just like a fun little system to collect for. And it plays well. And some of the units have TV out. There's a console as well. Like, it's just, it's a fun device, and the price is low enough that it's managed to find that audience. So maybe somebody like Sega sees that and says, hey, we could do that, because unlike the mini consoles, which are like locked down devices, this could be a way to sort of more easily bring their classic catalog back again somehow. But they've done that enough where I feel like they'd have to find some kind of spin to make this more interesting. I don't know. And also, like, doing a handheld well to make it actually compelling is tricky in terms of screen quality, screen selection. Like, if they just slapped like a 16:9 LCD of some sort, like, in there, that would be pretty crappy for that, I have to say. But if they actually properly source like a good 4:3 panel, you know, they take care of the treatment correctly, something like what was in the Ambernic RG477M, a panel like that, maybe too expensive for what they want to do, would be pretty nuts in a little dedicated handheld unit. So I don't know if they're going to do it. I'd like to see them try something. I still have my Game Gear Mini, though, it's the Game Gear Micro. I don't know if you ever used one, Rich, but the screen, it's like the size of a thumbnail. Like, literally, it's very, very small.
Yeah. To which my question is, why?
I mean, it was a fun little toy in that case.
I guess from my perspective, the question is, like, what kind of games do they want to run on it? Because I know the games that I really want to play, and it would be like, you know, the Dreamcast and the Saturns, that sort
of arcade games is what I would want.
The arcade games, yeah, you know, the Model 1, 2, and 3 games. I mean, that would be awesome. Like a handheld with, you know, Model 1, 2, and 3 titles on it would just be incredible.
Would.
But, you know, all of that sort of custom hardware, how's the emulation on that? Could be a bit tricky. I don't know. Will, do you have any thoughts on this?
I don't have any thoughts on this particularly, but I just wanted to say that I already have the Sonic the Hedgehog mechanical keyboard.
Our audio listeners can't see it, but he held that up, and it is indeed very Sonic the Hedgehog-y.
Hold it up again. I want to see it.
This is the show and tell portion of the show.
Yep.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, that's quite nice.
This is made by High Ground. They also do a different design in black for, you know, Shadow, obviously. And they do various mouse pads. And this is currently what is on my PC for testing purposes.
Huh. I like it. Looks cool.
Okay, good stuff.
So, you know, if they want to take any design notes from that, then, you know, get in touch.
Fair enough. Okay, what a great way to end the show, because that was indeed the last question. So if you enjoyed it, please do like, subscribe, share, that kind of stuff. Ring bells for apparently instant notifications, that sort of thing. Patreon.com/Digital Foundry. Join us. High quality video downloads of everything we do. Early access to DF Direct. The chance to pose questions for this show and the main direct. Ad-free website, which we'll beautifully curates for us. But that's all from us on this one, and I guess we'll see you soon. Thanks for watching and supporting Digital Foundry.